This Sunday and for the next three, we will be listening as Jesus proclaims to us what the late Leonard Cohen called the staggering account of the Sermon on the Mount, which I don't pretend to understand at all. Cohen was about 60 when he wrote those words. They're from an album from the early 90s, and he was just soaked in life and love and loss and wisdom and God. He knew that sometimes the wisest thing a human being can say when encountering a mystery is, "I don't understand." And there's a lot not to understand in the Sermon on the Mount. It begins today with this rapid-fire series of sayings or proverbs or aphorisms that we call the Beatitudes, Beatitude being a Latin word that means something like happiness. And they come from Jesus' mouth with rhythm. We could almost imagine a percussionist keeping time with Jesus as he speaks, the heavy drumbeat landing on blessed and for. Blessed, for. Blessed, for. Blessed, for. Or perhaps we could imagine the gathered crowd in sync with Jesus, and the way that sometimes we are when we connect with one another, we can imagine their heartbeat and their respiration syncing up with his, so that people inhale on blessed and the crowd exhales again on for. The rhythmic nature of these sayings is, in some respects, what makes them even more perplexing, more difficult to understand than they might be otherwise. Because most of the time, we understand and connect with rhythm really easily. Unless you are listening to experimental jazz, you'll immediately recognize the rhythm. So when ABBA's Dancing Queen comes through the PA system, or Lady Gaga's Poker Face, or if this is more of a musical theater crowd, the Gershwin's Nice Work, if you can get it, we connect with that. We're wired for rhythm, and we immediately dovetail into it, with the exception of the occasional drunken uncle on a dance floor at a wedding whose rhythm really bears no resemblance to the music. Most of us, perhaps there's a drunken uncle here, most of us, when we hear rhythm, immediately say, "I know this, I can sing with this, I can dance with this, I can clap or stomp my feet along with this." But Jesus' words do not match the easy understanding of his rhythm. I read a whimsical article a number of years ago in which an author asked children, or maybe a single child, it might have been the author's own child, to complete popular proverbs or sayings. So the author gave the child the first half of a popular saying and said, what is the second half? So the author said, for instance, "A bird in the hand is," and the child said, "is dead." Or the author said, "People in glass houses," and the child said, "are rich." That's actually a fairly reasonable conclusion if you think about, if you've seen a glass house, those are expensive to build. It's all fun and games until Darth Vader comes. And perhaps my favorite of them all, "Don't count your chickens because your chickens need their privacy." Actually is quite thoughtful advice. I can sort of imagine the chicken in the backyard somewhere in Portland saying, why are you counting me? I just leave me alone. I'm doing things. I wonder what would happen if we played that same game. We played that game of complete this sentence. complete this proverb, but the opening words we had to work with were blessed are. What would come next if we said, not necessarily even to a child, not necessarily even to someone who doesn't know the Bible, to anyone, what comes next when I say blessed are? Well, let's think about how we use the term blessed. Let's think about how our neighbors use it, how we ourselves use it. Pretty often when someone is talking about the vigorous state of his bank account or the amount of real estate that he owns, he will say, "I've been really blessed." When someone is talking about their health and how at age 60 or 70 or 80 or 90, they're doing pretty well, they're pretty vigorous, they're doing okay while a lot of their friends are injured or hurting or have even died, people will say, "I've been really blessed." When people talk about a marriage that has endured across the years, and every now and again I have the huge privilege of hanging out with a couple that is celebrating a 50th anniversary or a 60th or in one case a 70th, stop and think about that for a second. When a marriage has endured over that time, people will say, "I've been really blessed." And I recognize that last one. I'm into my third decade with Phoebe now, and when I think about that, I say that very thing. I've been richly blessed. So if that's how we use blessing, then what do our Beatitudes look like? Well, blessed are the wealthy. Blessed are those who manage to dodge loss and grief and hardship. Blessed are those who succeed in this dog-eat-dog world. Blessed are the white men. Especially blessed are the white men who were born into the middle class. Especially blessed are the white men who went to college. Especially blessed are the white men who chose a sensible career. Especially blessed are the white men who are straight, or at least have stayed successfully hidden in the closet. Blessed are those who put themselves and their family and their tribe first. Blessed are those who say America first. Blessed are the winners. But that's not where Jesus goes at all. Picture him standing on the mountainside, the crowd pressing in. He is surrounded by this sloping rock, which makes a kind of natural amphitheater around him and which functions as a kind of natural public address system. He speaks out into the crowd, his voice hits the rock and bounces back amplified. There's a throng of people around him. Jesus is up on a rock so he can be seen more easily. He looks around and he says, "Microphone check." And the rock hums with his voice. And then he begins. "Blessed are those who are poor, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called children of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." And then in the ninth and final one, Jesus breaks the rhythm the way sometimes happens at the end of a poem or a song or a rap number. And he says, "Blessed are you." Blessed are you when people revile and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely for my sake. For your reward shall be great in heaven. They did the same thing to the prophets. Jesus is like a pitcher standing on a mound. And the catcher is in his squat making signals to Jesus, saying fastball, curveball, slider. But Jesus just keeps on shaking his head no. Today, he says, today the only thing I am throwing is wild pitches. I'm going to aim for the dirt in front of the batter. I'm going to aim for the crowd behind the batter. I'm going to aim straight at the batter. Jesus is following rules, but they are not our rules. They are rules that only he knows. I imagine St. Paul sitting in the broadcast booth. He is leaning forward, breathing excitedly. Paul has the sense this is the greatest baseball game he has ever been to in his life. He's wearing this headset and talking to the audience at home, and he says to them excitedly, "The pitching of Jesus is foolishness to the world." And you and I are in the bleachers and wondering what to make of this. We bought a ticket for this event. We paid money to be here. We heard that Jesus was the greatest pitcher of them all. But as we watch one pitch after another sail wide, as we watch the catcher get out of breath from running around the park trying to catch up with the balls, we start to wonder. Jesus' pitching sure looks like losing. So there we sit in the bleachers, and we stand on the mountainside, and we think to ourselves, we look to one another and we say, well, maybe I shouldn't speak for you. Maybe I'll just speak for myself. I look and I listen and I say, I don't understand at all. But I want to understand. I'm trying to understand. Lord, I am trying to understand. And sometimes I catch a glimpse. Sometimes I catch a glimpse of where Jesus is coming from and where he is going with these strange blessings, with these beatitudes. I catch a glimpse when I visit with people in my office, or in their homes, or in a hospital, or a hospice room, and people tell me about loss and hurt and grief and injustice, tell me about experiences that they wish hadn't happened. And then they go on, this thing that I wish had not happened, this enormous hurt, there's a gift in it as well. Someone will say that when she was sitting at her father's bedside during his dying, it was an uncommon gift to be with him. Someone else will talk about the time after an accident, getting T-boned in a car. Who would want that? And then she'll go on, but the time when I was in the bed recovering afterwards, it was the first time for years that I slowed down. It was a kind of gift. Someone else will talk about a betrayal or an injustice, something terribly unfair, and say, it changed everything. Not all in a good way, but some of it, I just suddenly knew this new thing about myself and about life. And I recognize that in my own life. When my heart has been broken open, those are moments when I have learned something profound about myself and about my neighbor and about creation and about God. I'm not suggesting that I don't find God, that we don't find God in jubilation or in the everyday we do. But somehow to encounter the fullness of God, we need to go into the loss, into the darkness, into what Paul calls the way of the cross as well. Blessed are those who mourn. I catch a glimpse of where Jesus is going when I participate in working for justice. I've brought this up a few times over the last few weeks, but I think it bears repeating. So many people, when talking about the meal that we host on Fridays, will say something similar. Dan and Ann Huvel, who come to the 8, said this just 2 weeks ago. I went there in order to serve other people. I went there in order to give something away, and I was surprised to find that I ended up receiving something. I'm starting to wonder if I'm receiving more than I am giving by participating in this ministry, by participating in feeding people. When we look beyond ourselves, it changes something. There's a blessing in that. I had a similar experience last week. Phoebe and Miriam and I went down to the Women's March. I was disappointed not to have a pink hat to wear. Phoebe and Mimi had them. I just had a regular hat. We were there for a hard reason. We were there in response to the inauguration of a president who regularly and casually has engaged in misogyny, in words, in action, and now in legislation. That's a pretty brutal reason to be gathering. And yet, being there was energizing. I was so filled with hope and possibility. I don't think I was alone in feeling that. I was just sent away with this kind of this charge and this commission, ready for the work of, well, what are we going to be called to in the coming years? Activism and resistance and compassion and just an alternative kind of witness. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for justice. And I catch a glimpse of where Jesus is coming from and where he's going with these Beatitudes when I read the rest of the gospel. And I realize that these 9 rapid-fire sayings are not for Jesus a hypothesis. They're not an idea or a concept or something that he's trying out. They're how he actually lives. Jesus is poor. Jesus mourns. Jesus is meek. Or some scholars argue that of all the Beatitudes, meek is the weakest translation of what the original Greek suggests. Those scholars say that this would be better translated, Jesus is nonviolent. Jesus thirsts and hungers for justice. Jesus is merciful. He is pure in heart. He is a peacemaker. He is reviled. He is persecuted for righteousness' sake, finally going to the cross. This is, in other words, about right now. It's not about something that happens later. Often we hear the word kingdom of heaven, and we assume that Jesus or Matthew, in using that term, is talking about later on, but that is not what Jesus is referring to at all. Keep on reading in the Sermon on the Mount. This is a spoiler alert if you haven't gotten that far yet. And Jesus teaches us this prayer that talks about things being on earth as they are in heaven. This is the work of bringing the kingdom of heaven, the kingdom of God, right here, right now. This is what Jesus does across his life, and it's what he commissions you and me as his disciples to do as well. This is the hard and the joyous work of discipleship. And boy, we've got some work to do. We often speak of America as a Christian nation, And if what Christian means is that we go to church, then I guess we are. We are a Christian nation. We've got going to church down pretty good. But there are other respects in which we are not Christian at all. There is nothing Christian about vilifying Muslims. There is nothing Christian about denying health care to the poor, to the chronically ill, to veterans. There is nothing Christian about building walls against those who are suffering mightily. Half of the refugees trying to get out of Syria are children. Stop and think about that for a moment. That is a staggering statistic. Those of you who know your history will know that in 1939, Canada and the U.S. and Cuba all turned away the MS St. Louis. On board the MS St. Louis were 908 Jewish refugees from Europe trying to find their way to safety. And my home country, my adopted country, and Cuba all said, you can't come in. Historians argue about how many of the people on board died when the ship was returned to Europe. The guess is between 200 and 300. So a third of the passengers, between a quarter and a third of the passengers, died in the concentration camps. That is a shameful part of our history, and folks, we're doing it again. James Martin, the wonderful Jesuit scholar, pointed out that the order to seal our borders against refugees came at the same time as the March for Life and the remembrance of the Holocaust, Holocaust Remembrance Day. So we were sealing our borders against the least of these. At the very same time, we are saying the words pro-life. At the very same time, we are saying never forget. God help us. This is the staggering account of the Sermon on the Mount, which I don't pretend to understand at all. But I'm trying to understand. I'm trying to say yes to it with my life. And I believe we can say yes to it. I believe as church, we can say yes to it. I believe that we can join in with Jesus in inviting the kingdom of heaven nearer, in building the kingdom of heaven right here and right now. I believe that with God's help, a time will come when Jesus will look at you and at me and say, "Blessed are you."